Well, I might as well tell your dowries later that I've got a cold. Therefore, we will have to ask your indulgence if the Greek gets a little flat or something of that nature. We have a very interesting subject, however, and one which I believe has been rather generally neglected. And to begin with, naturally, our interest lies in Greek religion and philosophy. We must, therefore, realize that modern man, Western man in particular, knows very little about Greek religion, although he has some knowledge of Greek philosophy. The reason he knows almost nothing of Greek religion is because he has assumed that Greek mythology is Greek religion. And this is not true. We must begin to separate these values clearly in our own thinking. Greek mythology has come down to us as a wonderful collection of fables. Many of them, like the fables of Aesop, with considerable moral and ethical significance. Some of them, like the great epics of Homer, so stately that they seem for a moment to be scriptural. And we have difficulty in not recognizing or accepting in them the deepest convictions of a people. But the fact remains that these epics, these poems, and these dramas are not Greek religion. We must also point out that of all peoples known to us, the Greeks matured in a somewhat different way from nearly any other culture group. If Greece attained distinction among men, it was largely as the result of a conspiracy of efforts arising within the Greek consciousness itself. Actually, the Greek civilization was created by artists. It was created by musicians, dramatists, mathematicians. It was created by philosophers and even artisans. And all these together created Greek religion. Religion came from the motion of the people rather than heavily bestowed by some strange and distant power or circumstance. Therefore, I think we should bear in mind that when we think of gods and refer to the Greeks, we must not fall into our own semantic trap and assume that their gods were like our gods. On the other hand, we must not fall into another dilemma, which even dear old Dr. Schweitzer seems to have fallen into, namely, that there must be a similarity between our gods and the gods of other men, or else the other men have no gods. That is another mistake. Too common, too easy for us to accept. Actually, our theology is peculiar to our own culture. Greek religion was peculiar to Greek culture. And we were not only unfortunate in the necessity for translating Greek into Latin, and finally Latin into a rather horrible medieval English. We were further unfortunate in the fact that the translators, step by step of this procedure, were almost all against their subject. It was very essential to them, as they formed this literary bridge between two cultures, to discredit the spiritual attainments of the non-Christian world. The Greeks were pagans, and their translators and their perpetuators were not of kindred belief. Thus, while men gladly and happily accepted Greek art and culture in many ways, and were proud to buy Greek statuary or have their children educated by Greek tutors, they did not want to touch or mention the horrible subject of Greek religion. Thus, Greek religion fell upon evil times in the very process of its descent from ancient to modern days. Now, when we speak about Greek religion, what are we actually talking about? We are talking about a people without a creed. Now that is something that's hard for us to understand. A people without a Decalogue, or a Sermon on the Mount, or without an Old Testament, or a New Testament. A people without what we would term a messianic revelation. A people who have never heard of the idea of religious intolerance. A people who did not recognize or realize that they could be orthodox or unorthodox. My, what blessed problems they escaped. A people, as one writer has pointed out, that could persecute a man for 10,000 reasons, but religion was never one of them. And because of this attitude, what was the religion of a Greek who was perfectly satisfied to let any man believe as he pleased? To our day, he would be lukewarm, lacking in real ecclesiastical zeal, and would be a very bad evangelist for any creed. But the Greek was not evangelizing anything. His religion was a strangely abstract quality in his life. Perhaps one of the reasons why he found no reason to defend it is because it was impregnable in its own right. It was not something that had to be saved every weekend, nor was it something in which religion itself was always trying to save someone else every weekend. The Greek religion was grounded so deeply in the life of the people that it was like the very air of the Hellenic states. It was theirs by birth. They did not claim it, they did not oppose it, they did not offend it, they did not defend it. They simply accepted it as an essential part of their own lives. Another point, of course, is that from a very early period, Greek religion was principally celebrated through mysteries or rituals. These mysteries bore no resemblance to the churches that we have today. There were great religious monuments, but these were memorials. These were raised in homage. They were not places of common daily worship. They were sanctuaries built in honor, veneration, or respect for the spiritual virtues of certain deities which have been recognized in the life of the people. Therefore, not going to church as we idealize religion. The Greek was much like some of the Asiatic peoples. Sanctuary was always available to him. He could go any time he wanted to, and he could sit quietly or kneel quietly in a holy place and have communion with himself. No one bothered him, no one talked to him. His religion was between him and his God. If he asked for help, there were priests to attend him or to prepare certain sacrifices that he might desire to have prepared. But if he wished to be alone and commune with his God, no one asked him why or what was the purpose of his visit. They did not ask him his faith. If he was a Hindu and wished to be in the Greek temple, it was enough that he wished to be there. There was no discussion, and never an effort to try to convert him from some other faith to theirs. Now, we would say that such a religion would hardly have much vitality, but it had a very strange vitality. First of all, it was lifted above every pettiness by which we create controversy and gradually corrupt the overtones of our religious beliefs. Men did not belittle it, berate it. They could not write histories of it or read histories of it, written in blood. These things were separate, distinct, and apart. And, of course, behind it all was this wonderful system of religious mysteries. Those who made religion their principal problem in life retired to the study of sacred arts and sciences. Here they passed through something resembling our university training. And after from 10 to 20 years of specialized training, they might either be attached to a religious house, a temple, a shrine, or something of that nature, or they might become philosophers and create schools and gather disciples around them. But these religious leaders did not preach religion, because they received their spiritual insight under obligation, under vows of silence. And it was the Greek way in religion, never to talk about it, always to practice it, to reveal it only by what you do. Therefore, when a great and beautiful temple was built, no one talked about the god. No one talked about why it was built. Men simply were still and permitted the beauty of the place to tell them its own message. And in this beauty and harmony and sublimity of atmosphere, they felt their religion and were content. Thus we have something that is rather hard for us to bridge across the centuries and appreciate. We have to, however, go a little further into this matter. We not only have to make a broad statement such as we have made, but we must try to defend it, demonstrate it, or prove it. A study of Greek literature, art, and theater will easily demonstrate the fact of it. But we have other problems that must also be reconciled. Our first consideration is, therefore, what did the Greeks really know about anything? How are we to estimate the place of Greece in the descent of human knowledge? We are a little afraid of the individual who praises constantly, and we are equally frightened of the individual who belittles continuously. Neither can always be telling the truth. Therefore, how are we to estimate? Was the Greek emerging from barbarianism? How did his culture and civilization compare with ours? How far have we progressed since his time? What do we know that he did not know? What did he know that we have forgotten? How shall we measure him in terms of a human being? Fortunately, we have a fairly detailed picture of Greek life. We know their habits, their foods, their activities, their policies, and their politics. We know of almost as much about them as we know of contemporary nations on the opposite side of the world, perhaps more, because we have made this study part of Western culture. We must realize, before we get through, that in the age of Pericles, slightly before and slightly after this critical period in Greek thought, covering the period, say, from the 7th century before Christ to about the 2nd century after Christ, that during this long interval of years, Greek culture ruled the world. Greece itself has always been a symbol of a kind of learning. It has always represented wisdom. And most of our concepts of knowledge have originated in Greek terms, Greek symbols, Greek concepts. Most of all, perhaps, we are indebted to Greece for the rise of the great philosophical systems, which have become in their turn the foundations of modern science. When we read the writings of Plato or Aristotle, Socrates or Euclid, we know that we are not reading the writings of a novice. We are reading the writings of a highly mature human being. We are reading words and thoughts that we must ponder even now, after nearly 2,500 years. We read in these writings thoughts, ideas that have dawned upon us within the last 5 years. We recognize, therefore, that our Greeks were, in general, able to produce outstanding creative intellects, outstanding in a way somewhat different from ours. We have builded well, but we have builded upon foundations set forth by others. Among these Greeks, there were builders who created their own foundations, who gave us the principles which we have since been able to apply to innumerable ends. We have today countless mathematical formulas, but the Greeks apparently gave us mathematics. We have many, many chemical formulas, but the Greeks gave us the great concepts behind these formulas. The same way in medicine and art. We've had many great artists in the world, but the Greek canons of art have never been entirely excelled. Thus we have in the period we call the Age of Pericles in Greece, estimated at 500, conservatively speaking, of the world's greatest original thinkers living together in a span of 300 years. If we scatter these thinkers out over 2,500 years, we would still feel that we were living in a period of extraordinary enlightenment. But here we have these immortals compressed into a few centuries, leaving an imperishable mark upon practically every form of knowledge that we know. We therefore cannot regard these as children, nor can we assume that they were stupid followers of stupid leaders. We cannot read the Statesman and Republic of Plato without realizing that we are dealing with a statesman, that we are dealing with a person to whom the problems of our day would not be unfamiliar, and that many of the principles set forth by him must either ultimately be adapted and adopted, or else our way of government will collapse. We have not outgrown these pioneers. We have simply come to ride over them and accept as immediate heroes those who have cribbed from the earlier authors. But actually, when we look back, we can say Greece was like the very contour of its land. Parts of it were low, and somewhere in the height and high parts of it rose the Olympian peaks, which reached practically into heaven and were the abodes of the gods. I think we must admit that the modern man has diversified the advantages of culture far more than the Greeks did. The Greek had his heroes, he had his wise men, but he had his slaves. Today, man has slowly brought knowledge as far as possible to nearly all members of culture groups. And where the knowledge is not inadequate, it is being improved until it will be. Whereas in those days, knowledge was rested in small groups. This we know. This was the way of that time. But we cannot forget that the citizen of Athens was undoubtedly a brilliant, gifted person, capable of careful and sincere thought, possessing many natural virtues and all the common vices that we have inherited with the virtues. But we do recognize that the Greek was a mature person. He was no more a child than we are. He was no more an adolescent than we are. And that the few hundred years that have elapsed since the rise and fall of Greek culture have not changed the essential picture of human life to any marked degree. Undoubtedly, we will for long be indebted to Sophocles, Empedocles, and men of that nature. We will have Aristophanes. We will have the great playwrights, the great poets, the great epic thinkers. And we will recognize the genius of these men. And we will know that they could not have lived in a wilderness, because genius must arise in an atmosphere, in some way compatible and suitable to its own production. If then these people were not barbarians, unless we likewise wish to be considered barbarians for the same offenses, then it is difficult to imagine that they would have permitted their religion to fall into the common mythology which we know. We find the poets making use of mythological terms. We find the dramatists doing likewise, and even the philosophers and the statesmen. Yet as we study these terms and the uses of them in drama, we must be careful that we do not assume that these dramatic usages shall be regarded as the highest and fullest and most complete statement of ideas, for they are not. We cannot afford to be in the position that we might be in sometime, 2,000 years from now, if someone should look around and say, yes, the American man, the Western man in the 20th century, had three gods he devoutly worshipped and built temples for, and among others, he worshipped a dove, which he called the Holy Ghost. Now, this would not be true, yet it could well arise in our thinking. It could arise in the thinking of future man. If we wish to belittle the beliefs of others, we can do it in that way. Yet with mature thought, we would know that such could not be the intention. And we know that the people of Greece did not intend to assume that their myths and legends were a true and proper statement of their religions and philosophies. These legends and fables had accumulated as folklore from the innumerable provinces and tribes that finally met together to form the ultimate state of the Greek Confederation. These various groups had their old legends, their wonderful accounts, which associated with every area of their land, just as we have the legends of the Rhine, or we can find a defined group of legends along the Mississippi River. If we can't find any others, we can find the ones Mark Twain left there. We can also find legends among our American Indians. We can find them everywhere. But these legends amuse the children and are a constant source of conversation, but are not the sober expression of our sincere and most earnest thinking. Yet because they were so used as a kind of alphabet, as these religious emblems and symbols certainly meant something in particular to the people of their own time, it is probably well for us to go a little further in this, because we are actually dealing with a kind of emblematic alphabet, a kind of language which perhaps originated in the mystery system itself, so that those who knew could communicate ideas under names. Those who did not know could not penetrate the inner form of the story. Thus we have religious allegory. We have simple statements used to conceal great and wonderful truths. Nor should we assume for a moment that this was limited to the Greeks. But we find it referred to definitely in the New Testament, where Jesus himself makes use of the allegory form, where he says, "This is the parable. The seed is the word of God." He is therefore not talking about a plant in the earth, but of something else, using a simple figure to represent it. The Greeks had long mastered this art, which perhaps they borrowed from the Egyptians, who had known it before them. Thus, we cannot assume that these Greeks were quite as naive as we think they were. As a strengthening point in favor of our position, let us think now in terms of the great cosmogonists and cosmologists among the Greeks, to see if we can discover evidences to support the idea that they were persons of discreet mind and proper learning in their own right. Probably one of the best of these ancient writers was Hesiod, who has left us the great Theogony, which is the story of the creation of the universe and of the gods and of mankind. This poem, for it is a magnificent epic in itself, with much of the grandeur of Homer and a tremendous power of reason and thought, sweeps through the entire mystery of creation. And it does so setting forth certain great and eternal principles. And if these principles are set forth allegorically, certainly we must admit that the same had to be true in the opening chapters of Genesis, which we cannot expect to have everyone take literally. Hesiod gives us a wonderful sweep of Greek creative religious thought. And we must also bear in mind the contribution of Pythagoras of Samos, who was perhaps one of the first to explore the order and arrangement of the solar system. We know now that Pythagoras, 600 years before the beginning of the Christian era, taught heliocentric astronomy. That is, knew that the planets moved around the sun, something for which men much later were burned at the stake. We also realize that Pythagoras was a magnificent mathematician, astronomer, physicist, that he was a musician, a musicologist of excellence. This man was not a follower of old folklore, but a great scholar in his own right. We also have the tremendous documents of Plato and Socrates relating to universal order, and the final gathering of all these principles together by the Neoplatonists of Alexandria and Athens. From the study, therefore, of the serious writings of these people, we realize that they had a profound understanding of the structure of the universe, of the nature of man, and of many other things. That such understanding would be in complete conflict with the idea that they actually and factually believed that the Olympian court was held on the top of a mountain, and that the gods and goddesses engaged in the various banquetings and activities with which we so generally and humanly associate them. Such is simply not conceivable. And the sooner we wake up to this, the sooner we will begin to recognize the latent possibilities in Greek mythology as a clue to forms of basic learning. Following in the works, therefore, of Plotinus and Proclus, the Platonic successors, basing their terms also upon Hesiod, and to a measure upon Homer. But in Homer, the religious factors are very largely subordinated, although the entire work has tremendous formula meaning, if you wish to go into the rituals and search for that meaning. If we wish to leave aside for a moment these things and go on to our search for core, we must therefore pause with the Orphics, the followers of the Thracian bard Orpheus. Orpheus is a very mysterious person who it is almost impossible to date. Perhaps he lived sometime between the 9th and 14th centuries B.C. He came from a distant place, and he brought with him a mystical religion, which he gave to the Greeks. The original meetings of these Orphic rites were nocturnal, held in secret places, and associated with music, the dance, and poetry. The hymns of Orpheus are among the most precious monuments of literature. But this Orpheus, strange, obscure though he may be, was the one who first apparently revealed to the Greeks the internal mystical content of their basic folklore, and perhaps opened to them the psychological doors of their own inner lives. It was only after the rise of the Orphics that Pythagoras and Plato could have lived and could have taught as they did teach, because the principal contribution of Orpheus was this pressure toward inquiry, the desire for man to recognize that things had more meanings than were obvious, and that beneath the surface of all religious structure, folklore, legend, and the like, there are secret meanings arising in human experience, meanings arising in human interpretation of legend and fable, and that the search must be for the substance and not the shadow, for the internal truth and not the external appearance, and that all these fables had to be opened as with keys, and their inner structures and bodies revealed to those capable of accepting the proper instruction. So the Orphics made possible the rise of our investigation of Greek religion. Now, this Greek religion was probably best exemplified by its philosophers, by its great scientific and intellectual leaders, and was best emotionally pressed upon the people by the great dramatists, poets, architects, and those who served the mysterious power of the cult of beauty, which was so powerful in the Greek way of life. In the Greek consciousness, God was ever revealed by man through beauty. Man, therefore, creating the appearance of beauty, or releasing beauty, was forever serving deity. The priest of God was the one who served the beautiful. And beauty might be of the intellect, it might be of the emotions, it might be of the body, it might be of harmony and order. Whatever this beauty might be, it must be served, for it is the divine in all things. To go to the Greek religion, therefore, it may be best, perhaps, to conceive of it as a kind of extensive monadology. The monadology of Baron Wilhelm von Leibniz is indicative of this subject. Monadology is a concept that all things exist in the form of monads, or of totalities. The totality or unity is always the total sum and substance of a thing. And that, as Leibniz points out, all things are in themselves monadal. That is, they are wholenesses. They are units within units, or surrounded by other units. And just as matter is composed of an infinite number of minute invisible particles, each in itself complete, although it combines to create a substance dissimilar in appearance to the elements producing or causing it, still, this monadology means that all things arise from unities or in unities, and that therefore there is a master plan behind everything in nature, and that master plan is totality. Wholeness, unity, oneness, or as Pythagoras calls it, the monad. And it is from the Pythagorean term, the monad, that the monadology concept arose. The monad, according to Pythagoras, is the one in terms of the total, or the all. The monad is different, therefore, from the unit. And there is this same difference as between unity and unit. A unit is one. A unity is one. But the unit is a one separate or dissimilar from other things. A unity is a one which is a total of all other things in itself. Therefore, the monad is the one in the terms of wholeness. It is the one in the terms of that to which there can be no second, anytime, anywhere. That there can be no duality involving two totalities. The Greeks at an early day of their thinking came to the realization that the root of existence lay in a one for which there was no two. And how to explain this and to discover it rested with Pythagoras. He said, certainly, we have diversity, we have number, we have many. We say many from one. But let us follow the Greek thought and say many in one. Because in the Greek concept, the primary monad is never divided. It may allow or permit a certain division within itself. But of its own nature, it is always, forever, one. All the confusion and diffusion of life, things scattered to innumerable extremes and extremities, still must bear witness to the fact that the one is undivided. This one, therefore, is a kind of total in which all things exist substantially and essentially. And to this one, which is the primal or eternal monad, the Greeks assigned the concept of God. Anyone who assumes that the Greeks were not aware of one deity is mistaken. All you have to do is read your Plato and Socrates to know that this is not so, for they were fully aware of the existence of one deity. The difficulty lay in the fact that they were so aware of this mystery that they declared it profitless to attempt to explain it. That this totality is best understood and best conceived if we make no effort to interpret it. The mere fact that it represents totality or unity or wholeness is as far as we can go. For the moment we go further, we must take away something. If we say that it has any attributes, we are immediately denying that it has certain other attributes. For if we say it is tall, then we say it is not short. If we say it is old, then we say it is not new. If we say it was begotten,
then we must say that it can end. Therefore, any way in which we attempt to define it must deprive it of some of its attribute. So the concept of monad, or totality, was perhaps not an incorrect one for the primary of Greek thinking. This primary they regarded, therefore, as all-inclusive. Everything that could exist anywhere, not only in this solar system, but in the most abstract dimensions of cosmos, both quantitative and qualitative, not only on this line of the continuum, but on any other line of the continuum. All these things that exist, have existed, or may exist at some future time, and all things in the process of transition from one state to another state, moving from that which is known toward that which is unknown, all the reverse. All these things abide as attributes of monadal unity. Nothing can be a surprise. Nothing can be new. Nothing can come from nothing. Nothing can go to nothing. Everything eternally is. Conditions change. Principles do not change. A thing which appears to disappear merely retires from an objective to a subjective state, but its substance is not different. Anything which appears to come from nowhere, but nothing can come from nowhere. Therefore, space or emptiness, as we know it, cannot be space and it cannot be empty. Actually, therefore, we live within a total monadal substance, of which its primary attribute cognizable to us is infinite potential. There is no limit to what it can be. There is no way of measuring what it has been. There's no way of solving really what it is. But whatever thing has been, is, or will be, has always existed within it, as the oak tree has always existed within the acorn. And within this magnificent, total, monadic unity, all qualified existence rises and falls, begins and ends. But that which is this monadal substance cannot rise or fall, cannot begin or end, and is referred to by Plato as the eternal animal. An animal from anima, meaning the animated being, or the eternal world soul, crawling forever through space. Having bestowed upon this, therefore, one peculiar power, the Greek felt he had done about all he could. He had bestowed upon this all, the term all. It is everything. It is not a being, nor is it not a being. It is not a place, nor is it not a place. It may be considered as an energy, as a substance, as an essence, as a principle, as a force, as a law, as a substance. In all these things, you are naming aspects of it. But you cannot string enough words together to name the substance of it, for it is the essence behind all aspects. Therefore, to say that it is alive would not be truly true, because then it would be susceptible of death, or death could exist. It is not alive in the sense that it was never not alive, or it will ever cease to be alive. It is. It exists. The Egyptians called it Tat, T-A-T, from which we have our word that, T-H-A-T. It is that. Whatever you look at, wherever you turn, whoever's face you gaze into, that is that, with a capital T. Wherever you see, you are seeing nothing but the substance of essence. You are seeing nothing but the extension of this divine thing. Now the Greeks did not call it divine, because to them, this in itself was an artificial designation. The moment you call something divine, you set up a contrary situation, or what the Hindu has with his Shaktis, or polarized divinities. If you say God is divine, then something else is not divine. If you say this deity is better than all other deities, then you again make a mistake. Because we are dealing not actually with moral levels, we are dealing with reality, with plain, unvarnished reality, thing as it is. And consequently, this thing as it is has a virtue of reality. And the virtue of reality is greater than the virtues of right or the vices of wrong. Things may be right or wrong, but reality is. And this beingness of reality is beyond all controversy, beyond all classification as we know such possible terms. So in finding or searching for a word, or a phrase, or a term suitable for this, the philosophers, and to a measure at least, theophics, came upon a simple statement for this particular level, this total monadal essence. They called it the principle of principles. They said of it that it is a principle because it is first. Also that it is a principle because it is an archetype or a rule or a law or a guide by means of which all other things are. It is forever revealing itself through its works, and the revelation is always a revelation of principles. Everything, therefore, that moves according to its own nature, and this the divine nature, is forever revealing its principles. Therefore, this energy, this eternal power, is the principle from which arises all principles, as we know them, in terms of law, or energy, or substance, or classifications, or categories, or concepts, or any division we wish to make, intellectual or material, in the forms and structures of nature. So this vast principle of principles, to these peoples, was sovereignty. It neither loved nor hated. It neither was for nor against. It existed forever in its own nature, forever fulfilling its own nature. And therefore, everything which it did of itself and by itself, and because of the principle of principles by which it operated, everything so done, so produced, so engineered, so manifested, had to be good, because there can be no other principle in nature. The Greeks were totally unaware of any anthropomorphism or any battle between eternal good and darkness. Their principles of evil, so-called, or their evil beings, were simply passing chimera, little incidents that arose in the tyrannies of men, or in the peculiar testings of providence. They had no major principle that could stand against the principle of good. It did not occur to them that such a thing could exist, because of what would this adversary be composed? It could only be composed of the substance of the one. It could only have the mind of the one. It could only have the emotions of the one. And possessing all these things in vast measure, how could it revolt against its own similar? Therefore, they had no presumption of this nature. They had no fallen angel. They had no lapsed kingdoms. They simply recognized that man and nature, in their various relationships, would occasionally stumble along for lack of insight. This stumbling they would call evil. But evil is simply man's ignorance of the truth. It has nothing to do with the substance and essence of being. Evil is man's misuse of the principle, through ignorance or through selfishness. And as a result of misuse, the principle, instead of working with him, turns against him, or seems to do so. It does not move at all. He has turned against it by the misuse of its principles. This results in the good appearing to be bad. But as soon as the wayward one has corrected himself and gone back in line, the bad then appears to be good again. These things are forever moving and changing. So we have at the beginning this eternal monad. And the Greek points, now coming to the aid of the philosophers, and the various scholars of different calibers tried to understand the nature of this principle of principles. And they frequently referred to it as all-present night. They often referred to it as darkness. Not the darkness of man's concept, but the darkness from which light was born. Because lights flare up and disappear, but the great Mother Night goes on forever. And it is in this Mother Night, or in this great sovereign darkness, that the principle of principles has its proper abiding place. Not only because this darkness appears to be the lack of light, but more correctly and completely, this darkness is man's lack of insight, whereby it is impossible for him to apperceive that which is concealed within the substance of cause. So of this great principle of principles, man is forever dark, because this is wrapped in its own inscrutability, which is the great night and the great darkness that envelops all things and in which all light has its day. But in turn and in time, night returns. So the Orthics wrote beautiful hymns to gracious night, the mother of gods and men, the mother of all creatures that exist in time and space. And they also assume that this great mother is the monad, the great ripe or fertile power, which is forever dividing within itself, causing within its own great ellipse, within its own tremendous structure, the whole phenomena of existence to take place as upon a mighty stage. When the Greeks began to contemplate this mystery, they realized that it began in its own inscrutable self, in its own nature, and that there existed first, as Pythagoras points out, that from the monad, which is the inscrutable principle of principles, there must emerge the possibility of duality. Duality is an attribute of the monad. The monad is capable of division, but never of being divided. In other words, two is the one in term of halves. The one stands. The two rises within it. And it may be, as Pythagoras pointed out, that the two may gobble up the one, eat it, devour it, as the gods ate their own children. Why? Not because of any tendency to destroy it, but because in the presence of the two, the one disappears. We suddenly see duality, and we hear about unity. And because duality is visible and unity is invisible, the philosophy built upon duality eats up the philosophy built upon unity. Just as we say today, cooperation is the most desirable of all states. This is unity. Competition is the most practiced of all conditions. This is duality. And we say, yes, cooperation is a beautiful idea. But competition is a fact. The two has eaten up the one. Because the weight of reality has moved to the two. Competition is a fact. Unity is something we wish might be. What we do not realize is that unity remains always as the only reality. And all the things that appear to be different from unity are to that appearance difference vanity. But we are unable to know this. But unity giving birth out of itself or within its own nature, for this unity is a great womb which encloses creation. And the embryo which is creation is born within it. And actually, when it is born into existence, it is still born within it, because it is born like the Hindu universe within the womb of the great Mother Meru. So in the Greek concept, the duality arises within the substance of eternal duration or eternity. And the substance division which takes place, as Pythagoras says, in the duad. And whenever speaking the number two or referring to the duad, he spat upon the ground, because it was the beginning of illusion. The moment you believe there are two, you can believe there are any number. And the moment you cease to believe there is only one, in that moment, you pass from wisdom to ignorance. Because all ignorance rests upon the belief that there is two or more. And to recover from that ignorance is not easy. So Pythagoras thought you should emphasize the point rather graphically. In any event, the duality, according to the Greeks, resulted in the emergence out of or within the eternal principle of principles, two peculiar abstractions, which they call ether and chaos. Now, ether, as the term may apply, is a kind of nutritious vapor, a kind of life substance. It is a substance which has an energy element within it. It is also what was called by the Platonists the bound. Ether had a place. It had a kind. It had a condition. And against it was polarized its opposite, chaos. And the firstborn of eternal light was a twin birth of ether and chaos. Sometimes ether is referred to in the Orphic hymns as eros, or love. Sometimes it is love and the winds that were first born. But ether represents more than love as we know it, for it represents the nutritional tenderness of life, forever supporting and sustaining. And chaos represents the abyss, the pathos of baby, the hyo, the meaningless or terrible confusion of things. Therefore, we have the universe divided now into two principles, the bound and the infinite. Bound being ether, the infinite chaos. But this is now infinite in the term of infinite confusion. Here is the greatest conceivable number. Chaos is the greatest conceivable number, which means the greatest conceivable illusion. Every number but one being an illusion. The greater the number, the greater the illusion. An infinite number becomes infinite illusion, as opposed to infinite truth. And out of this also comes the bound, or ether, which becomes the one and the numbers, emerging out of the monad, or the numeration. So one, or ether, is the number as first of many, the father of multitudes. And the multitudes are the extension of these powers into various expressions of activity. Then, like the Druids, who may have derived some of their knowledge from this, the Greeks believed that the bound and the infinite, that is, the stress or pressure between the one and the many, resulted in a whirling motion, which was called a kind of nebula, a spiral whirling in space. And that from this whirling, there was gradually formed the structure of a great egg. And this egg was a kind of second world. And this egg was patterned after the principle of principles, in the sense that it was an enclosing thing. But unlike the principle of principles, it was already enclosed within that. So this was a kind of internal egg within the great sphere of ageless and eternal time. And this whirling sphere, composed of bound and infinite, plus minus, reduced the whole equation to a mathematical formula. And then, as this reached a certain degree of intensity, or densification, the egg broke. And from the egg burst the great deity Phades. Phades is almost exactly the same described figure as that of the cherub of Ezekiel. It is the winged being with the heads of the bull, the lion, the man, and the eagle. And in this tremendous concept, Fades represents the revelation or the objectification, the emergence of the principle of principles in its first modification, its first major descent. It has become now not the principle of principles, but the principle of beings, which is the second aspect of its own nature. And as in the ancient concept, there were always three divisions. Every motion of Greek mythology and Greek philosophy moves upon a triad consisting of a father, a power, and a mind. The father, the power, and the mind. Now, in this particular concept of things, the father is our principle of principles. The power that comes forth from that is the whirling of ether and chaos and the production of the egg. From the egg bursts the mind, Fades, radiant with all the attributes from which are to emerge the concept of a rational world. Now Fades, therefore, becomes the principle of principles in its aspect as now the principle of being, and in its further aspect of universal mind. This, however, is divine mind, resting eternally in the principle of principles. Nothing that we have now discussed has been seen by the eyes of man at any time from the dawn of things. These processes took place within the mystery itself, and all that we have is the symbolical description of them. Now, from the great throne which it had established, in the midst of the great field of the egg through which it had broken, it followed the same idea that you find later in the story of Castor and Pollux, who were born from a single egg. And we find now...